So we shall continue today with the simplest example of computing the correlation functions using the dual gravity. And so I remind you that that was the example of the scalar field, in ADS5, and we started with Euclidean signature. The idea is, I remind you what was the setup. The setup was the following, that we wanted to illustrate how in practice to realize this recipe. The recipe was that the partition function of our gauge theory was approximated in the limit of infinite large Toft coupling and infinite large NC. It was expressed through the type 2b supergravity action that depended on J, and the meaning of this J was the boundary value up to some normalization of the bulk field that coupled to the particular operator in supernormals whose correlation functions we wanted to compute. So the simplest example, was the coupling between the dilaton or fluctuation of a dilaton field, delta phi, which we'll denote by phi, from now on, which coupled to a scalar operator. And such a scalar operator can be, for example, the trace of f mu nu squared, the gauge invariant operator in supernormals. And from Dirac-Bohr infinite action, you can actually deduce that the coupling should be of this form, so with appropriate coefficients. Later on, we will discuss, and also in your tutorials, we'll discuss the coupling of a different type when the role of this operator will be played by, for example, some conserved current, J mu, let's say some U1 current, and then the bulk field that couples to this current will be the bulk gauge field, A mu. In this case, it will be a graviphoton coming from dimensional reduction of type 2b on a phi sphere. And another example, which will be of direct importance for us, will be the coupling of the stress energy tensor, which is yet another operator of our supernormals gauge theory. And this operator will couple to the fluctuations of the graviton, of a gravity field, which is just a graviton H mu nu. So I remind you that all these objects, all these fields, are fluctuations of the background fields. So generically, we have a background plus the fluctuation, and it is this fluctuation that couples to the operator on the in the supernormals. So one example is for example the G mu nu background, right, which is given by our ADS5 in zero temperature case, or ADS Schwarzschild black hole in, if you turn on the temperature later on. And then H mu nu is the fluctuation, right? So this H mu nu is the same, is the fluctuation of this field. Okay, so this is the recipe of what you're supposed to do if you want to compute a particular correlator. First, you identify which field couples to, by symmetries and other considerations such as DBI action. You identify it's a non-trivial task, but it's doable. You can identify which field couples in the bulk to a particular operator of interest. And then you deduce equations of motion for this fluctuation. And equations of motion you always deduce from the set of equations of motion which determine the background. So these are type 2b low energy equations of motion, which we had written on board last week. Okay? But again, so these were equations of motion for fully nonlinear sort of partial differential equation coupled and so on. What you need to deduce from these equations of motion is the equations of motion linearized for fluctuations. So you take these, so you had a tutorial for F5, right? But generically for any field, you need to identify what is the source of this field, right? So in type 2B set of fields, we had the dilaton, and dilaton obeyed the equations of motion, the equation of motion, which roughly speaking was the box acting on the dilaton, and then perhaps there's a metric attached. I mean, this box, of course, has a metric in it. And then there is some right-hand side which depended on various form fields, which were coupled to the dilaton. So it wasn't completely trivial equation, but the ground. So first of all, the ground has other fields, meaning forms except of five equal to zero, and the dilaton background itself was a constant, right? So phi was equal to the constant field. So this is a constant. The dilaton plus a fluctuation, So you substitute this into your equations of motion, but you also have to take into account potentially fluctuations of all other fields. So if you have metric, for example, you need to convince yourself that so G mu nu, right, the metric G mu nu is sitting inside this box because this is a box in curved space time. So what you need to convince yourself with is that if you give fluctuation to your metric, right? So you write down generically, right? Because generically all your fields may have some non-zero fluctuations, and you have to linearize with respect to all these fluctuations. And then when you do this, right? So you expand your box, you expand your phi, and then the right-hand side, assuming that all fluctuations are non-zero, and then you're expanding to linear order, right, in all fluctuations. And then you get a system of equations, and then you see that, all right, so I have a coupling of my fluctuations, or perhaps to linear order, my fluctuations are decoupled. So they don't connect to each other, right? And then they can set consistently, for example, fluctuations of metric in this particular equation. I can set fluctuations of metric H mu to zero. And I do not source any fluctuations of my scalar. If you can say that, then you can say, aha, I can only consider fluctuations of a scalar field and nothing else. Everything else can be set consistently to zero. Okay? So this is a non-trivial step which people have to. So you sort of have to think it through again, looking at the full set of equations of motion. And doing with this set exactly what I just said, because otherwise, of course, in this simple situation, it's almost obvious or almost immediate that you will see that nothing will be coupled to fluctuation of a dilaton, and all you get is the equation for a minimally coupled massless scalar in ADS5, and nothing else. But in more complicated situations, you might have other fields which couple, like Maxwell and so on, that couple to your field of interest. So for example, if you're interested in the correlator of two stress energy tensors, right? So you suppose you want to compute this, right? T mu nu, T rho sigma, let's say, of k, of minus k. Maybe at finite temperature and density, but maybe at zero temperature and density, doesn't matter. So how would you do that? You know that, okay, so you're interested in these correlators, so your appropriate bulk field will be H mu nu, the fluctuations of the metric, great. So you turn on fluctuations of the metric, and you need to find the equation of motion that this fluctuation H mu nu satisfies, okay? But when you derive an equation for H mu nu, so one kind of straightforward thing would be to just you have this equation R mu nu equal to the right-hand side. So you expand this R mu nu. You expand this R mu nu as R mu nu naught, right? So this is R mu nu of G mu nu plus small fluctuation. And you linearize this in H. So you have R mu nu, which depends only on the ground field G mu nu. And then there is some R1, which can be computed fairly easily. which will be linear in H mu nu, and then higher terms in H mu nu. And this is fine, except that you need to make sure that other equations do not couple your H mu nu to something else. So for example, we don't couple fluctuations of H mu nu to Maxwell field. You might have an equation which mixes together fluctuations of A mu, the gauge field, for example, and H mu nu. Okay? And this is only the conclusion that you can make by looking at all set of equations of motion that you have and carefully analyzing how these fluctuations couple or decouple from each other. Okay, so that's an important step. So in the case of dilaton, as I said, the background field of a dilaton, so this is our background solution for our brain. The background solution dilaton is equal to constant. You can set it to zero if you like. And then the equation for the fluctuation delta phi, which we will denote by little phi here, this equation follows. So equation, or you can do the same in also in the action. So sometimes it is maybe easier to look at the action rather than equations of motion. But one way or the other, you will get this action, which comes from type 2b. And we wrote it on the board last time. So it has this prefactor, square 10. Then there is dz, d4x, and then z to power minus 3, which is coming of square root of minus g in this case. And then the kinetic term of little phi. So our little phi is delta phi of the background value of the dilaton, right? So this is dilaton fluctuation. Plus di phi squared. And we can add the mass term. Maybe at some point we'll put this to zero, but just to be more complete, right? So let's add mass term. So as I explained last time, so this prefactor is coming after integrating over a five-sphere coordinate, because we only consider fluctuations which depend on the ADS coordinates of the metric in this new incarnation of the brain ADS 5 piece of the metric five-dimensional, right, where you have Euclidean, four-dimensional Euclidean space, and then the radial coordinate is denoted by z. I remind you that z was something that had this relationship to the radial coordinate r. And so the horizon, so z equal or going to infinity corresponds to r going to 0. So that's the Poincaré horizon. And z going to 0 is the boundary of our ADS. So what is the goal, right? So what we are going to do? So this is a part of the action. There is an equation of motion for this delta phi, or for delta phi background or little phi. What is the recipe? The recipe was the following: that we have to solve this equation of motion with a specific boundary condition. And the boundary condition was this little phi approaches on the boundary, right? Approaches on the boundary of ADS. The particular value we'll introduce some notation later, but let's call it phi naught. And this phi naught, so this phi is a bulk field which depends on z, and then on these four-dimensional Euclidean coordinates xe. But on the boundary, it approaches some value phi naught, which depends only on x now. And this, maybe up to some normalization, will be our current j with respect to which we will take the functional derivatives. And if we want a two-point function, we have to take this derivative twice with respect to j. So we solve the equation of motion. The solution will depend
will depend functionally on the boundary condition on this J. We take this solution, we substitute back into the action here. The action is written right here. This action on shell reduces to the boundary term. So it will depend only on J, on the boundary value of this current. And then we take the functional derivative twice, and this is supposed to be our correlation function. So this is the strategy of how we compute the correlator. All right, any questions at this point? Is it clear what we are going to do? Because the rest will be just solving the equation of motion and doing precisely what I did, but it will be slightly technical, so it's important to people are content at least with the strategy. Detect any discontent. So, okay. All right. So, technically, what we want to do is the following. So, it is convenient because we have the in the metric we have this translational invariance with respect to these four coordinates. It is convenient to introduce the Fourier transform. And phi of z and x Euclidean can be written in terms of the Fourier image, the standard way when you solve the linear PDE of this type. So the equation, so let me write it like this. So I will introduce this mode f sub k, which will depend on z. So we do a Fourier transform with respect to the Euclidean coordinates only, right? So this is that, and then there is a Fourier image which will depend on k, but dependence on z is not touched at all because Fourier transform doesn't touch it, and here let me introduce this F naught of k, just for convenience. So the boundary condition. So let me just continue. So SSE. So if I introduce this Fourier transform, then the action. And again, this is an exercise for you if you haven't done this before. So what I want to do is simply to substitute this decomposition, Fourier decomposition, into the action and write down the result. But before doing that, we are integrating over z. Let me introduce a cutoff. We said, so in this metric, z is going from 0 to infinity. But in everything of interest will be happening at the boundary of ADS at z equal to 0. But we will take a limit. And in order to take a limit, so let me introduce z equal to epsilon. And epsilon will go to 0. So this is a cutoff at the boundary, which eventually will be taken to 0. But we will see that it will produce a number of divergences. And we'll have to deal with the divergences, just like in quantum field theory, you have to deal with you have to regularize your action, and then take your cutoff to. Okay. Yeah.
Just one technical detail: when you write the Fourier transform of phi, why are you pulling out the boundary term like that? Right there, in the first equation, you're writing as an integral of f phi naught. Phi naught is supposed to be the value of the boundary?
Yes, that's right. Yes, yes, yes. So this whole field, so this is the Fourier image, right? This whole field is Fourier image. It will be convenient for me. Okay. It's just a matter of convenience. Later on, I will write it down explicitly. Right. That the image, right? So this whole thing will depend on z and k. And it's just a matter of convenience. I will normalize my mode little f, so that it will go to 1 at the boundary, okay? And then whatever, this prefactor is our J. So we will take functional derivative with respect to this thing, right? And this will go to 1 at the boundary. It's just a technical thing. So I have introduced cutoff, and so we integrate from epsilon to infinity. And then, so there is this little technical thing. D for k prime will be delta of k plus k prime over z cube. And here, what you have is dz of fk, dz of fk prime minus k, k prime, fk, fk prime, plus m squared, l squared over z squared, fk, fk prime. And finally, there are two of these prefactors, f naught of k, f naught of k prime, right? So what I have done, I introduced, so the action is quadratic in our field phi. So obviously, you need two fields to substitute into the action. And when you write down, because k is a dummy variable, right? You integrate over k. So in order to not to mix them together, right? So these are different variables. So you insert one phi where your integration variable is k, and another phi where your integration variable is k prime, not equal to k generically. You insert it into the action. Then you do the integrals. You discover that one of them gives you delta function and so on. So all of this requires just one action, so to speak, right? So you need to insert and see how it looks like. Now, the equation of motion so the equation of motion for the mode F is the following: double prime minus 3 over z f prime minus k squared Euclidean plus m squared l squared over z squared fk is equal to 0. Now the boundary, so let me write there is a boundary condition. Let me write the solution first, and then we'll talk about boundary conditions. So this equation is essentially a Bessel equation. And we'll talk a little bit more about generic type of differential equations that appear in this context. So remember that. So these are equations for linearized fluctuations of a specific background, and specific background in this case is a pure ADS 5. In more complicated case, so what you will encounter in tutorials and we will encounter in lectures this week will be a slightly more complicated background where you have ADS Schwarzschild black hole. That will not be pure ADS anymore. It will contain a horizon. The solution will be slightly different. The differential equation will inherit, so the structure of the differential operator, which is a differential operator of fluctuations, right? So we have a nonlinear system of equations. We linearize it. But of course, the differential operator, which comes as a result of linearization, inherits the structure. It remembers what kind of background. It depends on what kind of background is determining the equations of motion. So in the case of ADS, the differential operator for zero temperature for a simple ADS 5 is very simple. This is just a Bessel equation. More generically, for asymptotically ADS backgrounds, you will have a different type of differential operator, which only reduces to Bessel equation in the simplest case, right? And that's why we have chosen this as a simple example, because we can solve this exactly. So more generically, the type of differential operators, the singularity structure of differential operator and the boundary conditions and many other things are determined by the background, right? And there are classes of such backgrounds, the classes of such differential operators. So for example, if somebody tells you the words BTZ, for example, black hole, right? So then
then this correspondence with differential type of differential operators and so on would immediately tell you that BTZ means that this is a hypergeometric equation. So no matter what kind of fluctuation you have in a BTZ background or something which reduces the BTZ background, right? You know it is guaranteed that you can solve it analytically because this is reduced to hypergeometric equation, solution of which is well known since 19th century and Riemann and so on, right? So this particular equation has a solution which is, well, it's a second order equation, so there are two independent solutions, which I will write as I nu of kz plus b with integration constant a and b, which depend on k, right? So let me emphasize this fact that these a and b, they are function of k, and they are extremely important, because ultimately the ratio of b and a will give us a correlator. Okay, and so these solutions are probably well known to you. I put two here prematurely. So nu is the square root of 4 plus m squared l squared. Right, so for massless, if you have massless minimally coupled scalar, then nu is equal to 2. And most probably, very quickly, I think we will go to, so one can treat the generic m as well, so that's not a problem. Maybe in tutorials you will be asked to do that. But let's put m to 0 to avoid any kind of technical complications, which will not be very important. So these are so-called modified Bessel functions, also known in the literature as Infeld function and MacDonald function K. Now the boundary conditions, right? So we need to take care of the boundary conditions. And let me specify to m equal to 2. So in this solution, I will have synthesis equal to 2. And what kind of boundary conditions? So boundary conditions are extremely important. So what kind of boundary conditions I want to impose? Well, there is one boundary condition that is imposed by the correspondence itself, that my field at the boundary should reduce to this phi naught with respect to which I will take the derivatives, right? So that's one condition. We'll take care of this shortly. Then what else? We have two boundary conditions because second order differential equation. The second boundary condition would be dictated by the behavior of our solution at infinity, at z equal to infinity. We need our fluctuation because remember that this f is a fluctuation of the dilaton background. We don't want this fluctuation to be extremely large or infinite, right? Because otherwise it's not a small fluctuation anymore. So we need regularity everywhere in the bulk of this solution. And knowing the properties of the modified Bessel functions, one can say that, when z is large, for z going to infinity, we know that the behavior of I will be proportional to the exponent of the argument, k times z in this case, with some prefactor which is, if I remember correctly, this is something like square root of pi over 2z, something like that. But that's irrelevant for our purposes. The point is that it blows up at large z, I. But k, on the other hand, again, so there is a square root. But then it actually goes to 0, so it's exponentially suppressed. So if we want a regular solution, so regularity at large z will require that coefficient a is equal to 0 in our solution. And then the second boundary condition is at z equal to epsilon. We want this function fk of epsilon being equal to 1. because then we can say that our solution, right, in the Fourier space. So our solution in the Fourier space will. So let me call this phi. I don't know phi k of z, right, which is by definition is fk of z phi naught of k, right? We want this thing to reduce to some coefficient at z equal to epsilon, which will be taken to infinity, and this will be our j. All right? By design, I mean, we need this property because of the recipe that we discussed last time. So how can I achieve? So I have to normalize my mode in such a way that it reduces to one. And kind of the trivial way of normalizing this appropriately would be to declare that my solution for m equals 0 is simply equal to this, k times epsilon, right? I declare that this is the regular solution in the bulk of ADS5, right, which satisfies this property that at z equal epsilon, it is trivially equal to 1. Okay? I can introduce any constant in front of this to satisfy this property. So the obvious thing is just to divide by the solution itself at z equal to epsilon. Right? So this is the solution with the required property. And then so what is the next step? The next step is to so in my action, right, I have this action, right, which already depends quadratically on J. So this is, if you want, this is J, so J is function of K. So this is J of K, this is J of K prime. So taking functional derivatives according to the recipe would be trivial because my action already depends quadratically on J. So this whole thing, so I can already take these functional derivatives, right? Nothing prevents me from doing this. But the point is that then my correlator will be this whole crocodile, this whole expression that is not very convenient to deal with. So I need to understand what this expression is. It still contains derivatives with respect to z and so on, right? So I need to take my solution, this one, put this into the action, and I also need to write down this action on shell, right? Because it's a bulk action, but we know that because of this variation procedure and so on, so how you do this, right? So you can write down the action as something which is proportional to equation of motion, plus a boundary term, something which depends only on the values of your fields at the boundary, right? The boundary term of the action. So this is a standard procedure in any field theory or classical mechanics, if you want. So the action on shell, all right, reduces to the boundary term so let me write this down. So this is again this pi cube L to the 8 and then 4 kappa squared 10, and then there is the integral of d4k prime over 2 pi power 8, then there is this 2 pi 4 from the delta function four dimensional of k plus k prime. Here comes phi naught of k prime. And here is this famous boundary term, fk prime of z dz fk of z,
So you have to compute the derivative divided by z cube. Nothing happened to z cube. So you have to compute the derivative first, and then compute this at the boundary, right? So you compute this at epsilon, but there is also another boundary at infinity, right? So your action, when you integrate by parts, your action in z, you will get two boundary contributions, one from infinity, from Poincaré horizon, and one from epsilon. Okay. Well, so let me introduce a notation. Let me introduce notation that will be useful later on. So d4k, d4k prime over 2 pi over 8, f naught of k, f naught of k prime. And I will call this whole thing the capital F, which depends on z, k, and k prime, and is supposed to be computed between infinity and epsilon. And then the two-point function, so we will compute this object in a moment, but then the two-point function, so the two-point function of the operator O coupled in Fourier space, coupled to phi, to fluctuation of a dilaton, is given by, so this is O of k, O of k prime, and in gauge theory, right, so how do you compute this? You take the second variation with respect to j. In our case, the role of j is played by f naught. With respect to f naught of k, f naught of k prime, right, at f naught equal to 0. And this is minus 2 f 2, because it's a quadratic thing in f naught, minus 2 z k prime computed between epsilon and infinity. And this is minus 2 pi to power 4 delta of k plus k prime p cube l to the 8 divided by 2 kappa squared 10 dimensional Newton's constant f k prime dz of fk over z cube. So this you have to take the derivative again and then substitute infinity and epsilon. So this whole thing is a function of epsilon only. And this is the answer. And now all we have to do is to actually substitute. So we can substitute the solution. But we can note, so one thing we can note, and this is important for our next step, computing the same thing in the Lorentzian signature. So we are working in Euclid. So our momentum k is Euclidean four-dimensional momentum. So note that we got unique solution, right? So this solution is unique, and we sort of anticipate that it is good that it is unique, because as I mentioned in the last lecture, in Euclidean spacetime, you expect only one correlation function, right? It's not that variety, you have variety of retarded, advanced, Feynman, Whiteman, and so on. In Euclidean spacetime, there's only one. So the fact that you've got unique solution is a reflection of this fact. Now, not one thing that. So your little f is the MacDonald function k with this asymptotic. So if you take a derivative with respect to z here, you don't spoil this, right? It still will be the exponent which gives you 0 at infinity, right? So the contribution of this f at infinity will be equal to 0 because of this exponent, which kills everything at z equal to infinity. So note note that f of z equal to infinity kk prime is simply equal to 0. And also recall the relationship between kappa 10 and our parameters of the of ADS we had in one of the lectures, L to the fourth divided by NC. So combining these together, we find we find the following. So we find that the in Fourier space the correlator of our scalar operator k prime is equal to n squared c over 8 pi squared 2 pi to the fourth of the delta function k plus k prime, right, Euclidean, right, this is four-dimensional delta function. And then whatever is left is f prime of epsilon divided by epsilon cube. Okay? And I will put this square brackets here, saying that, so where this means taking the limit of epsilon going to 0 and discarding discarding contact terms. And I will explain what this actually means. Right, so let's see what exactly what this thing is. We know exact solution for fk, right? We know exact solution for fk. So all we need to do is to compute the derivative and expand for small epsilon, okay? And this is an exercise which can be done by hand by using the asymptotic behavior of Bessel function. In this case, just expansion of Bessel functions for small argument. And this is strongly recommended, especially for a young generation who grew up with all these tools like MATLAB, Mathematica, and all this evil helpful, but you know you should be aware that these things. So there is some theory behind this, right? So it's not just pressing the kind of series expanding whatever in whatever computer tool you have. You need to understand why this is so and where this is coming from. And of course, there are these sources that you need to know about, right? The Baitner Day free volume, right? The Abramovitz Tigan, the Gradstein Rizek, the Prudnikov, and so on. So if you want to know more about where to find the sources, talk to me after the lecture. That's essential kind of kit of a theoretical physicist. But from a point of view of kind of being more lazy, if you want. You can just plug in into Mathematica and compute the derivative and then expand for small epsilon. And one way or the other, the expansion that you get will have the following form. So f prime over epsilon cube will, so f prime k depending on epsilon over epsilon cube will give you the following terms. Minus k squared over 2 epsilon squared minus gamma, the Euler constant, k to the fourth divided by 4 minus k to the fourth log epsilon divided by 4, and then finally minus k to the fourth log k over 2 divided by 4 plus terms which are higher order in epsilon, right? So you are taking the limit of small epsilon. So of course there is an infinite expansion here. But all higher orders, higher terms will be positive power of epsilon, and they will happily go to zero in the limit of epsilon going to zero. So you neglect, I mean, you put, I mean, this in the limit this is zero. Now, however, what you will get in this limit is also a number of terms that are finite, like this one, but also singular, like for example this one or this one, in the limit of epsilon to zero. And then finally, will be this term, which will be actually the correlator. Now, this procedure that I indicated by this square bracket leaves only minus k to the fourth over 8 log k square term, and this is our final result. But let me explain why we throw away all these other terms, even though they are singular in the limit of epsilon going to zero. So here, so what happens here is the following. So one way to so what we are doing here is computing the correlation function in a slightly cavalier way, so to speak, right? If you want to be completely rigorous, what you have to do is the following. You need to regularize your action first, so that whatever thing you're computing would be finite in the limit of epsilon going to zero. And in quantum field theory, the appropriate procedure would be adding the certain set of counter terms to your action, and then doing your computation, right? So you're not dealing with divergent object, right? You're dealing with convergent object. And then in the end, you put your cutoff to infinity or zero, depending on how the whole thing was set up, right? So you expect from quantum field theory, so you're computing the two-point function of two composite operators, in this case, trace of f mu squared, trace of mu squared. You expect that the result will have certain divergences because these operators are composite operators. And despite the fact that beta function is equal to zero in n equals four, you still have, for composite operators, you still have divergences. And in quantum field theory, you would introduce the appropriate regularization and deal with it. And we did this, right? We didn't put z equal to zero immediately. We introduced the cutoff z equal to epsilon. But now we need to add counter terms to the action. So one has to add to the action which is written here as E, one has to add counter terms. So more rigorous. So add counter terms to the action. So these counter terms, so the action, remember, the action is the action of a type to be gravity, right? So obviously it is covariant, right? It's a piece which comes from a well-defined theory. So your counter terms can only be of a class which is admissible by this type to be supergravity, right? Namely, the counter terms must be covariant as well. But you only need counter terms on the boundary, right? You don't need them in the bulk of your space-time because your action is regularized on the boundary. So that in the limit of epsilon equal to zero, right, they must kill the singularities, and in particular, they must kill these divergent terms. Now, this procedure can be developed. It's not terribly difficult. It's known by the name of holographic renormalization. And we will not be doing this, but if you are interested in detail, so for many simple calculations, this procedure is equivalent and kind of not conceptually kind of necessary. You look at these terms, and in a moment I'll tell you how to, right? You know what to discard, right? So, but there are cases when things are far less obvious, especially if you're dealing with backgrounds which are not asymptotical ADS. And then you need to really classify all possible counterterms that you can add to your action from the start, and with appropriate coefficients, and sort of to kill all the singularities and so on. So this is an important piece of holography. You can look at various lectures by Skenderis and various other people, and I think I have some references in the list. If not, then I will add them. But kind of let's look at kind of from a point of view of poor man renormalization, right? So what we can kill here is the number of so-called so-called contact terms. The contact terms. So remember that this is in Fourier space, right? What you need to do ultimately, you're interested in this correlator in the position space, and terms which are proportional to powers, integer powers of k, would correspond to derivatives to terms in position space, which will correspond to derivatives of delta function, number of derivatives of a delta function, right? Remember that. So your delta function has a representation where you have e to the I k x, right? So this is your delta function dk, right? So if you take one derivative, you just have a k jumping in front. If you have two derivatives, you have k squared jumping in front, and so on, right? So in that sense, if you transform this whole thing back to the position space, you have a number of derivatives of delta function, right? And these terms are called contact terms because they are only non-zero at one point when x equal to, so delta x minus y, for example, right? Because what you're interested in is the correlator ultimately of O of x, O of y, right? But these coefficients will give you only the non-trivial contribution at x equal to y. Otherwise, they are completely zero. Okay? And we know what they look like. They look like the delta function. So this will be the contact terms. And therefore, this and that can be happily discarded. And the only non-trivial term remaining here is this one. And again, so if you're not completely happy with this Cavalier renormalization, then read Skenderis, right?
Is this divergence persistent if I set the mass to a value different from zero?
Yes. In fact, if mass is not equal to zero, you will get these divergences, but in fact, you will get something even less pleasant because in the case of M not equal to zero, the leading order asymptotics will not be as nice as if you expand z squared k squared k2 for small kz, or if you multiply it like this, k z squared of k2 kz over 2. So this for small kz, this will go to 1. If you have non-zero mass, the situation will be less pleasant. You will not get an asymptotic equal to 1. That's why you have to divide. So then you divide by, so you have this, the solution will be proportional to some epsilon z nu, k nu at kz. But if you divide, then yes, the solution will go to 1 as required. But in general, you will get also divergent terms, but with different structure. Yeah. All of this is sort of the kind of the good news is that you don't have to. I mean, again, for people who maybe dislike this way of kind of getting rid of divergences by hand, the declaration is that there is a regular procedure no different from renormalization in quantum field theory. So you just add a number of counter terms, right? These counter terms will kill the divergences completely. So you will not see this appearing at all, right? Okay, finally, we have the result, this one. And let me write this in a more clear way. So in
Euclidean space, our correlator is of k of k prime Euclidean, and this is minus n squared c over 64 pi squared k to the fourth e log k squared e. I just emphasize that this is Euclidean momentum. And then there is this 2 pi to the fourth delta 4 of k plus k prime. So the exercise in the tutorials, one of the exercises in tutorials will be to convert this back to the position space. Yeah, so this is, if you want, historically, this is a famous result by Gubser, Klebanov, and Polyakov. February, I think, of 1998, which historically, there was also a paper by Witten where he used different methods to get essentially the same correlator, but this kind of machinery that I was describing was due to these offers. The importance is that it was the first set of two papers that produced the recipe of how to actually compute something with ADS CFT. Okay, so Montesena's paper of November of 1997 was a very important conceptual step, stating that there is a duality, right? But you need a tool, you need the recipe of how to use it in practice, and that was very shortly that was developed there, and that was historically the first result for correlation function using the gravity side. So this is the Young-Mills correlator at strong coupling, and this was obtained from gravity. So in the exercise in the tutorial, when you transform this to the position space, you discover that your correlation function will be proportional, and you will check discover the exact coefficient. It's 1 over x minus y to power 8. And in general, we do expect this this dependence. So in general, we expect this particular correlation function to be proportional to 1 over x minus y to power 2 delta, where delta is the scaling dimension. So for operator, for example, which is the trace of f mu squared, the scaling dimension of this operator is 1 over length to the 4. And that's the definition of a scaling dimension. So this means that we expect O of x, O of y, right, being proportional to 1 over x minus y to power 2 delta, just by on dimensional grounds. Now, this delta node, is delta, which in principle can depend. So delta will depend on the coupling. And delta node is the value of delta of lambda perturbatively, right? So then lambda is going to 0. We get this delta node. So what happened here is that the ADS CFT result ADS CFT
calculation and AdS CFT result confirms that delta, because our calculations in gravity were done in the limit of infinite lambda, right? The delta of strong coupling is equal to delta at weak coupling and is equal to 4. And this result is one of the results which is due to non-randomization theorems was known before. Was known before in n equals 4 supernormals. Okay. So again, n equals 4 supernormals was one of his supersymmetric theories which were explored in 1980s, and various things were protected from running with a coupling between weak and strong coupling, and this was one of them. So it was a multiplet of operators, and this was one of his entries in this multiplet for whom it was known that delta is not renormalized. Delta is actually constant, it's the same at weak and strong coupling. So this computation was the first, if you want, non-trivial check of the correspondence, because again, so this result here was a result of the gravity calculation, and the gravity calculation is, in terms of Young-Mill theory, is the calculation at infinitely strong coupling, and it confirmed, therefore, the expectation that was known before, namely that the delta at lambda equal to infinity is the same as delta at lambda equals 0 equal to 4. Now, the last remark for today is that, of course, so the remark so of course the not all so not all n equals 4 operators, to put it lightly, right? So not all are protected from renormalization, and in general, therefore, we expect that delta of lambda generically is a non-trivial function. And well, indeed, function which a great effort in the last 10 years or so was put into actually computing the dependence for various classes of operators in n equals 4 for dependence of this delta of lambda was a huge subject by itself, which we'll not discuss here. But again, so if you're interested in that, I can at least point you in the right direction. I don't really know this very well or at all, but I know that a huge progress, great progress has been achieved. So our goal remains the same, right? So this is an example, very simple. We know analytic result. In tutorials, you'll be asked to do various things again with this simple example, in particular, do the Fourier transform. However, what we really want to do is we want to compute something which is related to transport coefficients. And for that, we will need computation not in Euclidean, but in Lorentzian signature. We need some real time in the game. We don't, because when you compute transport deviations from thermal equilibrium, you cannot work in Euclidean space, because Euclidean space, everything is dead. Right? There is no real time, so everything was cooked up already a long time ago. So we need some recipe. We need some way to compute the correlators directly from gravity in the Lorentzian signature. And you already anticipate from our discussion last time that it will not be completely straightforward in the sense that in Lorentzian signature, you expect a number of correlators, the Whiteman function, the Feynman, the retarded advance, and so on. And that means that you will have a different types of boundary conditions that you have to impose in your fields, and your solution will not be generically unique. Okay? So tomorrow we'll discuss this recipe for Lorentzian signature and how to compute correlators in that case. All right. Until tomorrow.